Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-1322 et al. Responsible Regulation, Inc. et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency. Issue 1, Endangerment Finding. Mr. Day for petitioner CRR, Mr. McDougald for petitioners SLF et al., Mr. Mitchell for petitioner Commonwealth of Virginia, Mr. Cook for petitioner Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America, Mr. Lipschultz for respondent EPA, Ms. Purdy for respondent EPA, and Ms. Youngku for an intervener Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Day. I'll be arguing first on behalf of petitioners. As the clerk has indicated, there are four of us who will be arguing the endangerment questions this morning. Mr. McDougall will be addressing the science and record issues. Mr. Getchell will be representing the states with respect to reconsideration and delegation. Just Mr. Clark will be discussing statutory factors and EPA's failure to consider relevant portions of its subsequent follow-on decisions. And Ted Hadjiantic is here in case the court has any questions regarding the failure to consult with the Science Advisory Board, although he's not planning to provide argument. My portion of today's proceeding, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, by the way, on behalf of all of the petitioners. Only one of us will get up and address that if we have an opportunity to do rebuttal.
Well, we'll try to be quieter this morning than sometimes in order to perhaps have some time left. So. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, but we certainly welcome the court's questions at any point. I'm going to argue specifically with respect to a legal error we contend EPA has made in its interpretation of what's required with the endangerment determination. We believe EPA has erroneously decided to completely divorce its risk assessment from the subsequent policy consequences. Any risk assessment which fails to inform the contours of a rational policy undertaking, a rational regulatory regime, is necessarily going to ensure that whatever policy consequences are ultimately chosen by the agency are not well-founded or erroneous, which in fact is the case here. We think EPA's interpretation of what's required with the endangerment judgment violates this court's holding in Ethel. It extracts the term endanger from the Clean Air Act as a whole and thus causes EPA to fail to grapple, as it should and must, with the consequences of regulation under the rest of the Clean Air Act. We believe that it enshrines the prospect of incomplete and irrational decision making, which is effectively what we have, we believe, here as well. And it, in fact, authorizes ineffective and perhaps even fruitless regulation to address the identified risk. I would like to have the opportunity to address all three.
Maybe you could start, though, with Massachusetts versus EPA and explain why this argument isn't precluded by the court's decision in that case.
The court in Massachusetts versus EPA did not purport nor try to define all of the contours of an endangerment assessment.
True, but it did say it's a science-based judgment that relates only to whether there is, in fact, endangerment, didn't it?
The court said that it's a science-based assessment and that EPA had failed to consider the relevant science. Mm-hmm. We're contending here, Your Honor, that when EPA considers the science, it must also consider and articulate those portions of the scientific issues which will set the contours for a rational, if one is possible, mm-hmm. regulatory response. What EPA has done here is said, there's a danger,
right,
and now we're going to regulate, but it has not assessed those portions of the science which will then inform what rational policies can be adopted, if any, in response.
Is there anything that says they have to do that in one step in the endangerment, as opposed to making the endangerment finding mandated, apparently, by Massachusetts, or making the assessment mandated, and then proceeding with whatever regulatory scheme comes next in a second proceeding, as they did, based on the findings of the endangerment?
The EPA certainly has the procedural flexibility to do what they've done here, which is make an endangerment determination and then promulgate regulations. But in one of those two proceedings, EPA must discuss those portions of the science that will inform whether their regulatory response is going to be rational and effective. What EPA has done here is have two separate...
Do you mean in the endangerment proceeding, or do you mean...
I mean in endangerment and in the tailpipe rule which follows. By separating them into two separate decisions, EPA has contrived to make it possible not to discuss those portions of the science of climate change which have to be grappled with to have a rational policy response.
Are you talking, is this your point about, for example, human adaptation to climate change? Is that what you're talking about, that the agency failed to account for the extent to which humans can accommodate to climate change?
Adaptation and mitigation, which Mr. Clark will address, are portions of the policy consequences.
All right, so that's the other lawyer. Well, then what exactly did EPA fail to take it? What science didn't it take account of when it made the endangerment finding here?
I can answer that question by telling you exactly what EPA said here. In connection with the tailpipe rule, EPA said that its emission standards would represent a reduction in the adverse risk associated with climate change. But then it went on to say, and I'm quoting now from the joint appendix at page 509 in the tailpipe rule, that the extent of risk reduction is not formally estimated for this action. So what we have is a tailpipe standard that does not tell anybody what risks of climate change have actually been addressed. And what we're saying, Judge Tatel, is that if EPA were to go back and make that assessment as we think it must, it would not be able to do that based on the record that's been made in the endangerment finding, because there's no discussion of that portion of the dangers of global warming which can or can't be logically addressed with reasonable and legal regulation under the Clean Air Act. Perhaps the best way to illustrate this for you, Judge, is to make clear that logically the existence of a danger does not necessarily translate ipso facto into rational, legal, and effective regulations to address it. The Clean Air Act, for example, may not be a vehicle which gives EPA the ability to effectively address the danger.
Wait, could we just go back to the statute? So, so you're looking now at the. Are you focusing on the EPA has made the endangerment finding, and now you're focusing on the tailpipe rule, right?
EPA has made an inadequate endangerment finding. I'm sorry. It's our contention, Judge, that EPA's endangerment finding is incomplete in its attention to the policy consequences of subsequent regulation.
But that's why I asked you at the beginning about Massachusetts versus EPA, which says pretty clearly, I think, I mean, maybe you think I'm misreading the case, but it seems to me it says that this is a science-based judgment, not a policy judgment, and it relates only to the question of endangerment, and it rejected EPA's non-scientific reasons for not making the finding.
And we're not arguing here that EPA can or should not consider the science. What we're suggesting...
Well, I understand that, but you just said that it failed to consider some policy considerations.
I still don't understand.
Maybe you should just... Why don't you try again? If I understood your argument better, maybe it would work. What exactly... Are you talking now about the... You're saying the endangerment finding with respect to tailpipe emissions is inadequate?
The endangerment finding that's been made posits simply the existence of the dangers associated with climate change. It does not go on to then discuss how regulation under the Clean Air Act, in connection with the science that will now inform it, can yield a rational regulatory response.
Okay, where does that, what authorities, where do you get that from, either the statute or from Mass, the EPA? Where does that come from?
This court held an
I mean, I understand your argument, but where does it, what's the authority for that?
This court held in Ethel that the term, statutory term, in danger, is informed by its relationship to the rest of the Clean Air Act. Once a risk is found to endanger, That's only the start of the question. What then has to happen is the formulation of rational and effective regulatory response.
Mass v. EPA came after Ethel.
Bass versus EPA cites and quotes Ethel with approval in footnote 7 and does not, in our view, in any fashion reverse the discussion in Ethel, which makes clear that, Judge, whenever all you have here is a statute that requires the promulgation of an emission standard, whether the emission standard is going to be reasonable, effective, and rational will be determined by its relationship to the risks assessed. EPA here has taken the opposite position and said that it cannot consider and should not and must not consider how its risk assessment will inform the rationality of its regulatory response, which is a recipe for fruitless regulation, which EPA has engaged in here. That's what's wrong with the endangerment assessment. Not that they can't or shouldn't consider science, it's just that they haven't completed that analysis.
I'm not trying to be obtuse, but I'm not sure that I heard an answer to Judge Tatel's question about where the requirement comes from that you say exists for them to make those other considerations beyond the finding of endangerment. Massachusetts v. EPA compels them to do the endangerment process. You seem to be coming up with a lot of other things they were supposed to have done at the same time. And I heard Judge Tatel ask you where they came from. I didn't quite understand your answer.
The answer, if you in statutory terms, would be as follows, Judge.
Pardon?
The answer in statutory terms would be as follows. First, under Section 307(d)(9) of the Clean Air Act, any regulation that's enacted as a consequence of endangerment must be rational and reasonable.
That's a different question. In finding the endangerment, why do they have to consider something other than endangerment?
They have to consider subjects as part of endangerment, which will inform whether, and if so, to what extent, a regulatory response can be rationally implemented. The existence of a danger.
Massachusetts tell the EPA that if they found danger, then they had to regulate.
What?
I grant you that that process of regulation might consider a great many other things, but the first threshold here is the endangerment finding itself.
And we're not arguing that EPA can't or shouldn't find endangerment. They can, and the Supreme Court said they must consider that question. The court, however, in Mass versus EPA simply said and held that EPA has to then ground its subsequent actions in the language of the act and the statute. It didn't compel a finding.
I know this case may be broken up awkwardly at times, but that still gets past the endangerment and over to the tailpipe. Is that right?
Whether a tailpipe rule can be rationally crafted is a function of the risks it addresses. And when EPA says it will not consider how its risks can address the risk, we're going to have irrational regulation.
Let's go back to the statute again. I'm looking at 202A1. All right? It says, UP says that that EPA shall prescribe standards applicable to the emission of any air pollutant, right? We're talking about a pollutant here. You're not arguing it's not a pollutant.
That's correct.
Which, in his judgment, cause or contribute to air pollution, which may be anticipated to endanger public health. So where in that language is there any room for a decision based on anything other than whether the air pollutant at issue here, namely carbon dioxide,
because
contributes to air pollution which could endanger public health?
Because if the emission standard that's enacted as a consequence of the endangerment decision does not rationally and effectively address the danger, because that hasn't been shown.
I don't understand your argument. I'm sorry.
An endangerment decision or an assessment of science which fails to inform how rational regulatory emission standards can be crafted is incomplete. It's not that it hasn't been made. It's just not complete enough to inform a rational regulatory policy.
Did the agency, you don't quarrel that the agency found that greenhouse gas emissions contribute to, climate endanger public health or safety, right?
That's correct.
Public health or welfare. You don't quarrel with that.
We don't quarrel with the...
No longer quarrel with it.
EPA has found endangerment.
Okay, so are we beyond 202A1? Are we into 202A2? Is
no,
that where we are?
No, we're in 202A1 still because they didn't complete the endangerment assessment in a manner that will inform whether or not rational policy responses can follow.
Okay. Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
A little bit left. We'll hear now from McDougall.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Harry McDougall for the Southeastern Legal Foundation. May it please the court and counsel. I'm going to talk about why the evidence in the record shows that the endangerment finding should be vacated. I want to be clear at the outset that we are not asking the court to adjudicate a disputed question of science. Instead, instead, we are arguing a question of administrative law as it relates to the record. We're asking the court to enforce the statutory requirement of rational rulemaking and the prohibition against arbitrary and capricious rulemaking. EPA has claimed with 90 to 99% certainty that humans are the cause of most of the recent warming. And that is the conclusion that we contend violates the statute that we're asking you to enforce. The reason that certainty...
Excuse me, was that actually EPA's own conclusion, or was that the conclusion of the IGCC?
Not to be flip, but the answer is yes. The IPCC said that, and the EPA adopted it verbatim.
Now, can you quote exactly what the EPA said in adopting it verbatim? I will concede I do not have all of the JAs on this bench. This bench is not big enough for all the JAs.
I'll do my best, Your Honor. We find that it is very likely that human emissions are the cause of most of the warming in the second half of the 20th century.
I think that's an accurate quotation.
Right.
And very likely...
In that, I didn't hear the part that adopted verbatim the 90-95% language from the other study.
That's... Okay, I can answer that. The definition of the terms very likely, which is found at JA3355, translates into 90-99% certainty.
In one... Terminology from one source, right?
That's the EPA's terminology and the IPCC's terminology, Your Honor, for that term. The reason that high certainty conclusion violates the statute, Your Honor, is that the three lines of evidence on which EPA relies to draw that conclusion are themselves highly uncertain. And to say that three substantially uncertain lines of evidence can be rolled together to produce a very high certainty conclusion as to causation is irrational and...
You asked us, you said we're not going to judge science, and that's absolutely right, but as I listen to your argument, I mean, EPA, you agree we review this for abuse of discretion, right?
Correct.
Okay. So EPA looked at these three studies and concluded that the science was certain enough to reach its endangerment finding. Obviously, there's lots of uncertainties. It acknowledged all the uncertainties and accounted for them, but it made a judgment that there wasn't so much uncertainty that it couldn't make a reliable judgment. Now, how would you argue that that's, I know you disagree with that finding.
Yes.
You know, you look at the evidence and you obviously reach a different conclusion. And for all I know, you may be right. But to win here, you have to make an argument that EPA's decision is actually arbitrary and capricious.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
What is the argument for that?
If I could put it this way, the point we're arguing is abstracted somewhat from the underlying scientific disputes. And the point is this, is that logically, if you take three substantially uncertain lines of evidence...
I don't mean to interrupt you, but this is critical to your point. You say substantially uncertain. EPA reached a different conclusion about those reports. It found, looking at them, that although there were uncertainties, the evidence was sufficiently reliable to make the scientific judgment required by the statute. So you have to prevail, you have to show us that decision of EPA based on what it viewed as reports of acceptable reliability was itself arbitrary and capricious.
Right. Well, we're asking the court to test the logical proposition whether three highly uncertain
lines. My point is your logical proposition fails at its premise because EPA didn't find them unreliable reports. I mean, uncertain reports. That wasn't their finding.
Your Honor.
You would be right. You would be absolutely right if EPA had found these three reports, they're completely uncertain, and we look at the evidence and find sufficient reliability to make an endangerment finding. Then you'd have a case of arbitrary and capricious rulemaking.
Your Honor.
But the first step of their reasoning was that these were three thorough, peer-reviewed studies that, true, had uncertainties in them, were sufficiently certain to justify regulation. And as I said, you may well be right that that's wrong, but you have to overcome the arbitrary and capricious standard of review here.
Your Honor, let me see if I can put it this way.
Okay.
The three lines of evidence are temperature records, theoretical understanding of the climate, and computer models. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence in the record that we've cited in our brief, primarily citations to the assessment literature, the IPCC and the CCSP, mm-hmm. that shows the existence of substantial uncertainties in each one of those three lines of evidence. And for the most part, those are acknowledged, frankly, in EPA's documents.
Exactly.
And so we're not asking you to adjudicate who's right or wrong about.
That seems to be what you're asking.
Well, Your Honor, the point is.
You seem to be asking this, and I think the same thing is bothering me, that's bothering Judge Tatel, that you seem to be asking us to determine that the EPA is incorrect, which is not the standard. We could disagree with them. Maybe I do disagree with them, but that wouldn't win the case for you.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, and I'll keep trying as long as I got time on the clock, is that if you combine three uncertain premises that they have in this case, and you come out of that, you put those in the blender, and you come out with a 90% to 99% certainty conclusion that is an illogical conclusion.
You're really engaged in some martial arts to work that thing around to 90%.
Well, that's certainty. Your Honor, with respect, it's.
Assuming you're correct about that, nonetheless, does the EPA have to wait until it is faced with studies that have certainty to that extent before they can regulate?
No, Your Honor, they're not. But the fact of the matter is, they took the position that they knew the answer to this question with 90% to 99% certainty. And logically, there's no logical path from the uncertainties in these three lines of evidence.
If we send it back and they say we have reached this with a 60% to 70% degree of certainty, does that make the case sustainable when it's unsustainable now?
Well, it might. We would have to wait and see. But that would be a different case than the one that's in front of us. The risk assessments.
The hypothetical we do. It,
the risk assessment that's in front of us. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Josh.
Maybe we can get at this by drilling down a little bit into these uncertainties. Okay. Let's just one of these uncertainties that you're talking about. I think from the brief is about the uncertainty about solar irradiation. Right.
Correct. That's one of them, Your Honor.
And what you cite in the record is you say in your brief that there's a low level of uncertainty is the overall effect. Here, wait a minute. It's this chart in the record that you cite, which says there's a low level of scientific understanding.
Correct.
Of the degree to which the heating effect of solar energy can be quantified for the past several hundred years, right?
That's essentially correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, okay. Well, right. There is uncertainty about that. But there, according to EPA, it acknowledged that uncertainty. But according to EPA, there isn't any uncertainty about either the way in which the sun's heat affects the climate, nor any uncertainty about the effects of the sun on the atmosphere in the past 25 years. That's certain. We have actual data on that. So EPA's conclusion was, yeah, we acknowledge the uncertainty, which you've pointed out, but it doesn't affect our overall conclusion because, A, we understand the relationship between solar radiation and climate, and B, even more important, we have actual observational data for the past 25 years. There's no uncertainty about that at all.
The problem with that, that's what they say, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And the problem with that argument.
That proposition, right. Then your time will be up. Excuse me, go ahead.
All right, sir. The problem with that argument from EPA is that simultaneously takes the position that they have a low level of understanding of how the sun operates on climate and a high level of understanding about how the sun operates on climate.
No, they were only saying that back until the 17th century, we just didn't have the data you need to be very certain. But now we have observational data, and it is certain. At least that's the way I read it. Is that not right?
Well, Your Honor, the influence of the sun on climate is a controversial scientific topic, and that's why the IPCC ascribed a low level of scientific understanding as to its total influence and a low level of consensus. What EPA is talking about is a particular metric of solar influence called total solar irradiance. But there's a lot more to the sun than total solar irradiance, and that's why the uncertainty and lack of consensus numbers are stated in the IPCC report. Mm-hmm. And the EPA has taken the position that we don't understand it, but we do. Mm-hmm. And so the argument represents a classical logical fallacy argument from ignorance. What they know or think they know trumps what they don't know. It's analogous to a fellow looking for his keys under the streetlight because that's where the light is. My time's expired. Thank you very much.
Counsel, your time is up, and we will hear from Mr. Getchell.
Yes, sir. May it please the Court, Duncan Getchell for Texas and Virginia and various state intervenors. I'm going to address two overarching issues, one, certain endangerment errors, and two, reconsideration errors. I'll begin with reconsideration. A proper reconsideration requires notice and comment. When a rule, such as an endangerment finding, is nothing more than a statement of basis and purpose, altering it or extensively supplementing it requires notice and comment. The standard is, in the Clean Air Act, one of central relevance. If a person raising an objection can demonstrate to the administrator that there is evidence that was not previously available, and if such an objection is of central relevance to the outcome of the rule, the administrator shall convene reconsideration with notice and comment. Now, for 30 years, administratively, The central relevance standard has meant substantial support for the argument that the regulation should be revised. Now, if in fact an agency, the EPA, when it is given the basis for a claimed entitlement to reconsideration, has to engage that evidence to the point of producing a 360-page supplement with extensive new work, including new work of its own, which there's no comment allowed on until we get here and comment on it in briefs, then the reconsideration standard has been evaded. Now, we did not simply show that there was a substantial support for the argument that the regulation should be revised because it actually was revised. So we don't have to speculate about what the agency would have to do in the future. In order to engage with this new material, it had to, in fact, alter the endangerment finding, because if the endangerment finding is nothing but a narrative of why the agency thinks as a matter of science and policy that there is endangerment, then having to shore it up with substantial additional new evidence is actually changing it. The fact of the matter is that the agency, of course, says, oh, well, we certainly we must be permitted to do something other than simply look at what you gave us. But I submit that your choice is this as the agency. You can say this doesn't meet the central relevance standard. This does not provide substantial support for revision of the rule. And then you take your chances on judicial review.
Isn't that what EPA did? It said it didn't meet the standard, right? It wasn't an issue of central relevance and denied reconsideration.
My point, I guess, is that you're not entitled to shore up your record with a unilateral quasi-reconsideration and then say, see, we were entitled to reject the new evidence and the reconsideration.
Are they not entitled to give an explanation as to why they are denying reconsideration?
They are, but I submit that.
Is that what they did?
No, I think they did something more than that. I also think they violated the standard. If you look at the end of EPA's 75-page rebuttal of ClimateGate materials on temperature records and analysis, which is...
Give us a JA.
It's JA 47. It's volume 10 because there's some of that numbering problem. Volume 10, Roman numeral 10, 47, 10, and 11. And I'll 10 and 11. And I will read what they say. They say the arguments made by petitioners do not change EPA's views on the validity and reliability of the three major surface temperature records or the overall body of evidence supporting the basic conclusion that there is an unambiguous warming trend over the last 100 years, with the greatest warming occurring over the past 30 years. Now, this is not substantial evidence in support of an argument. This is the EPA saying you have to change our minds. And I don't think that's the proper standard at all. They do it in their brief at 19 and 20. They say, quote, that the petitioners failed to show that the science supporting the endangerment finding was flawed, misinterpreted, or inappropriately applied. That's a merit standard on reconsideration. That's not a correctly applied.
If the agency is going to make a judgment about whether your evidence is a question of central relevance, that is a substantial chance of showing, doesn't it have to look at your evidence? I mean, how can it make that judgment without reviewing the evidence you've submitted? And if they say, look, it doesn't change our mind, doesn't that mean that it doesn't have a substantial chance of changing their mind?
No, because
I don't know how. How would you do it otherwise? What would you... Tell us what the EPA take.
They were right. How could they have said so?
Yeah. What would they have said that would have satisfied you?
I think that, in fact, if you have to redo it, largely redo it in order to turn down the petition, then you violated the standard. I think.
Back to telling us what they're not to do. What is it you say they were to do that could have been upheld by this court?
Well, it may not have been upheld.
I'm not asking you to concede the correctness of the proposition, but assuming they were right, how could they have said so in a way that would survive?
What they should have said is that looking at the information already in the record and looking at the new information that's been supplied to us, we conclude that the central relevance test is not met. And then I could have tested that on appeal, but they weren't willing to put all their eggs in that basket. They had to do a unilateral reconsideration in order to shore up their position. I think
so your position is they did too much, and we should therefore find they erred in doing too much.
No, I think that what I'm asking you to find is they have tacitly conceded they needed to do a reconsideration if, in fact, they had to do all they did. That's what I'm arguing. Remember, in terms of whether or not, you know, if we haven't met the rehearing standard, then the rehearing standard's a dead letter. Because remember, there are three chains of evidence that they say support their endangerment finding. One is the physical understanding of the processes involved. The second is the historical estimates of temperature change. And the third is modeling. Now, the material that was provided to them is material which brought into question I mean, because there's certainly information in there that says that in the community of climate scientists, the physical understanding is poor and incomplete. There is evidence that the historical reconstructions, at least some of them, were tendacious. And there was a lot of admission that the models are poor.
Let's just take a very simple hypothetical. Okay, suppose in support of the petition for reconsideration, there had been just one study. And the petitioners argued that that study undermines EPA's conclusion that, about the risks of warming. And EPA looks at the study and sees that it's just completely flawed because, you know, it's got mathematical mistakes in it. It's just a completely flawed study. Now, is it, what should it do under those circumstances? Can it not say that and deny rehearing on the grounds that this doesn't, this study doesn't provide substantial support for the possibility that it will be reconsidered?
I think there's a spectrum from which, where they could say we've looked at what.
Well, just take that example.
Well,
Could they do that in that example?
I don't think that categorically analyzing one study, if that's all the reconsideration was based on, is error.
I'm trying to understand what you think the agency's responsibility is when a petitioner seeking rehearing or reconsideration submits additional data. Yeah. And I was trying to focus on that with a very simple hypothetical.
And I'm saying I'm not categorically rejecting that they couldn't do what you
said. Okay, so in my situation, agency could look at that and say, petition for reconsideration denied, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And to do that, it had to look at the study, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it didn't do any public, any notice or comment, nothing, right? So. I realize you think the evidence here is, obviously the evidence that you submitted in support of the petition here is obviously much more dramatic and substantial than in my hypothetical. But what did the agency do here that was different than what you and I agreed it could do in my hypothetical?
In response to a world event that caused every university and governmental institution that had been involved in this to have a reconsideration, none of which, however, reexamined the basis of the science, they didn't have the luxury of doing the same thing. They should have granted rehearing. And I would say that they have basically said, oh, look at these other studies. They concluded there was no academic fraud. Well, academic fraud's not the standard. The standard is substantial support for an argument.
You finished with your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
In that case, your time is up, and we'll hear from Ms. Clark, I guess, is next. This, you can't tell the players without a scorecard. You do have a scorecard.
That's right, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jeff Clark for the U.S. Chamber. I want to make two affirmative points today. One is about the absurdity argument, and the other one's about a duo of factors that the EPA ignored. But before I do that, I want to quickly clarify some points about Massachusetts versus EPA, especially given its central importance to this case. The first question was the one that came in response to a question by Judge Tatel about how exactly to interpret the case. I don't think, contrary, I think, to what you're suggesting, Judge Tatel, that you can interpret that case to mean that you focus exclusively on the science. The Supreme Court said in two separate junctures, it repeated this formulation about must conform to the authorizing statute and base its reasons for action or inaction on that. The key one, I think, is on pages 534 to 35 of the opinion. We hold only that the EPA must ground its reasons for action or inaction in the statute, mm-hmm. not in the science. But
this
in,
is
the,
in
statute.
The statute.
Yes.
Well, and the endangerment finding, right?
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, the entire statute. EPA had to consider the statute. You ordinarily don't interpret statutes based purely on one section or subsection. You look at them as a whole and you look at their structure. And that's the nature of the absurdity argument. So we don't think that an interpretation of that case that says it's focused exclusively on science, the Massachusetts versus EPA decision, is a correct interpretation of that case. For the same reason, in response to the question that came from Chief Judge Sentell about whether EPA is mandated, to look at it as a binary of, you know, endangerment finding yes or endangerment finding no.
I just want to go back to this point about what you're talking about. I mean, when the court rejected EPA's policy reasons. It said, still less do they amount for a reason justification for declining to form a scientific judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, those, the laundry list of reasons that the Supreme Court referred to there were reasons that were outside of the statute, which the court also emphasized in several places.
Non-scientific.
They were non-scientific, but they were also outside
sentence,
of the statute.
Sentence, what does this sentence mean that I just read you?
I think that's...
Still less do they amount to a reason justification for declining to form a scientific judgment.
Your Honor, I think that there were references, obviously, to the science.
We're bound by that decision.
You're bound by that decision,
I
mean, but...
Let's assume I completely agreed with you about the interpretation of the statute. How do I write the sentence which says, in the opinion, that, yeah, court said that about scientific judgment, but what it really meant was that EPA can also take account of a lot of other non-scientific issues. How do I do that?
I think you can easily write that because the court itself summarizes its holdings by saying that on remand, EPA must ground its reasons for action or inaction in the statute. It didn't limit the agency to scientific
That's
reasons.
A different question. I mean, that is a generality that it must grant its reasons in the statute. Could you speak specifically to how we're supposed to do, require them to do something other than look at the scientific evidence at the endangerment?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the fact that it was a rulemaking petition and that the court adopted the American Horse Protection Association standard. And so issues that were not reached by the court, whether, for instance, this would lead to absurdity, whether this was inconsistent with the structure of the Clean Air Act, those questions weren't reached by the Supreme Court. You can't read a decision on a rulemaking petition to foreclose questions that weren't before the court. Indeed, the petitioners in the Massachusetts versus EPA case said that the question, for instance, of whether NAAQS regulation could occur under the Clean Air Act of greenhouse gases, an issue that Judge Tatel wrote about in his dissent, was not before the Supreme Court. So if those issues are not before the Supreme Court, they can't be considered to lock this court into an exclusively scientific analysis. That's not what the case, how the case should be read.
That just proves that dissents aren't cert petitions, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I have to refer you back to the...
The thing sounds more like Scalia than it does like the majority in that case.
Well,
I understand Justice Scalia's dissent said they should have looked at a lot of... The court should let them look at a lot of other things, but... The majority doesn't seem to, does it?
With all due respect, Judge Sintel, I don't think so, because the factors that were excluded by the majority opinion were factors that were extraneous to the Clean Air Act. And so, you know, the court left open that there would have to be an analysis by EPA, and it put its blinkers on and refused to look at consequences under other parts of the statute. And let me then use that to go into the absurdity argument.
Give us an example, then, of a non-science factor that... EPA could lawfully or would legally be required to account for in its endangerment finding. Obviously, the Supreme Court listed three they couldn't, so they're off the table. What is one that they could?
We think the absurdity argument, Your Honor, because the absurdity argument is about how EPA's endangerment finding, according to EPA itself, leads inexorably to absurd results, the regulation under the PSD program. And EPA has to consider that factor.
Well, but didn't it consider it when it in the tailoring rule? Isn't that what the tailoring rule is all about?
The problem there, Your Honor, is that the absurdity can't be dealt. EPA said the absurdity can be confined to Section 169.1 by using the absurdity canon to rewrite the statutory thresholds. But you can't use the absurdity canon to rewrite statutes.
All right, well, give us another.
If you used it at the stage you're talking about, it rewrites... That's part of the statute along with everything else, doesn't it? I mean,
no, it doesn't necessarily, Your Honor, because
I'm not conceding that I buy the absurdity argument at any stage, but if I buy it, why is it more proper here than it would be at the next stage?
Because, Your Honor, we're not asking the court at this point to declare the EPA lacks the authority to regulate greenhouse gases because of the absurdity. Perhaps there's a way to avoid the absurdity. Tomorrow you're going to hear about three constructions of the statute that would avoid the absurdity. But even if you decided that all of those were foreclosed, because of the Chevron doctrine, EPA should get the first chance to look at whether it can actually resolve the absurdity without violating the absurdity canon, which is what it's done in construing Section 169.1.
Suppose we aren't persuaded about the absurdity argument, at least at this stage, on Tuesday as opposed to Wednesday. What? Give me another example of a. What's your strongest point about what EPA should have considered here that it didn't, beyond the science?
The absurdity argument is the key argument in terms of the structure of the statute. Okay. So there, I don't believe there are any other examples of things across the statute that we say they've ignored.
You're not talking about the beneficial effects, the potential societal benefits of greenhouse gassing or human adaptation. That's not what you're talking about, right?
Well, I want to talk about those issues, but I don't think those issues relate to construing Massachusetts versus EPA. I think those are ordinary issues of construing 202A and arbitrary and capriciousness. So let me turn to them since my time is limited, if I could. So let me deal with the adaptation mitigation argument first.
With the what?
The adaptation mitigation argument, or just really adaptation for purposes of today, I think you could focus on.
But let's be clear. You haven't identified anything outside of the science as to the endangerment determination. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Judge Tatel asked you the question, and your response was absurdity, and that was it.
The reason for the response and absurdity is because that's another aspect of the statute which EPA refused to look at, and the Massachusetts versus the EPA decision says that EPA has to look at the statute.
So your argument is an arbitrary and capricious argument? Not a statutory and construction argument?
No, it's a statutory construction argument and an arbitrary and capricious argument because of the fact that EPA used the absurdity canon incorrectly.
They used the absurdity canon way later on.
Yes.
They passed the tailpipe over to stationary source. That's when they're finally using the absurdity, right?
That's correct.
But the Supreme Court told them they had to make an endangerment finding.
Incorrect, Your Honor.
It doesn't sound to me like you're talking about endangerment when you start talking about the absurdity canon.
We flatly disagree with you, Your Honor, unfortunately, that the Supreme Court told them to make an endangerment finding. We believe that it told them to conform their actions or inactions to the statute.
Read the rest of the opinion.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
There's a sentence that says that. There's a general sentence. But did you read the rest of the opinion?
We did, Your Honor.
And you read that as not telling them they had to make an endangerment finding?
We do, in particular against the background principles of law. How could the Supreme Court cut off arguments about the statutory structure that weren't addressed in Massachusetts versus EPA, especially in the rulemaking petition context?
I see your point. Your point is that the Supreme Court said you got to ground the decision in the statute. And when EPA took account of the absurdity consequences, that was a statutory judgment, right?
That's correct.
So, where do you find any authority for the proposition that EPA had to account for that in the endangerment finding as opposed to later in the regulatory process?
There are two reasons for that, Your Honor. Thank you. The first is because EPA set up an inexorable chain. They said that once we adopt the endangerment finding, we must have PSD apply because the auto rule has been triggered.
Right.
And therefore, if you're going to trigger something that you can't avoid, you have to consider it back at the time you actually tip over the first domino. That's the first point. And the second point about this is that
logical fallacy. I mean, you don't have to consider everything that comes down the line when you knock over the first domino. Multi-step decision-making is not even uncommon.
Multi-step decision-making, Your Honor, is something that occurs, but the agency here refused to look at the factor, and this Court has repeatedly told agencies, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly told agencies, that they need to construe statutes as a whole, and they need to construe statutes according to their structure. And they blinded themselves to the fact that there would be an absurdity later, an absurdity, in fact, that they cannot resolve in Section 169.1, because in Section 169.1, what they want to get rid of are the statutory numerical thresholds. And numerical thresholds are the quintessential policy choices by Congress. They cannot be rewritten by agencies.
I thought this was more an argument that having made the endangerment finding based on its evaluation of the science, that then EPA should have stopped, because taking the statute into account as a whole, regulating motor vehicle emissions would produce absurd results because of its interpretation of PSD.
That's a possibility, Judge Rogers.
Your argument?
That's a possibility, but our argument is more than that. Our point is that in the first instance, the agency should have to try to reconcile and deal with the absurdity in a proper way that's consistent with the absurdity canon.
But I'm trying to understand the first first issue they had to face was whether they would make, as a result of a review of the science, an endangerment finding. And I'm just trying to be clear that that's not with regard to absurdity. The question is, what does the science show? Then the next question is, well, what do you do next? And I thought the briefs were arguing they should have stopped for a variety of reasons.
No, Your Honor, if that's the way that you understood it, that's not our argument that you should stop after you make an endangerment finding. Our point is that before you make an endangerment finding, you have to consider the entire statute and the results under it.
What EPA should have done is to say, let's just hypothesize that we, upon reviewing the science, would make an endangerment finding.
No, Your Honor.
We should not engage in that because we would have an absurd result.
Would agencies
apply that in regulating emissions?
Agencies, Your Honor, have a duty to consider the entire statute, and so there is a focus on endangering the public health in Section 202A, but our point is that the agency can't, like an ostrich or myopically, just focus on Section 202A, and especially
it can't engage in step-by-step reasoning.
It can engage in many instances, Your Honor, an agency could engage in step-by-step analysis, and then that could have impacts on other statutory sections. Impacts isn't the basis of our argument, though. What we're saying is that absurdity is a different kettle of fish. Absurdity is a situation in which the agency concludes, as it said here, that it was beyond Congress's intention to have the PSD program regulate greenhouse gas sources at small levels, small sources.
It was originally EPA's position in another iteration that greenhouse gases were outside of their compass at all. The Supreme Court said, no, they're not. They are within your compass. So aren't we past that step? Sometimes in reading petitioner's briefs here, I got the impression that Massachusetts hadn't been decided or wasn't binding.
Your Honor, we don't want to give you that impression, but I don't think you should go beyond what it is that Massachusetts decided. Our view is that it resolved the question of the meaning of the term air pollutant. And so we're not here to relitigate the meaning of the term air pollutant. But it did not decide all questions of whether it's consistent under the statute to regulate greenhouse gases.
You're not relitigating that today. Right? Tomorrow you are.
Yeah.
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, we're not. That.
But one of the arguments tomorrow was, well, we won't get into tomorrow today. Go ahead.
If I recognize that my time is over, but could I say a few words about the...
Can I ask a question? Yeah. I don't want you to sit down before you talk for just a minute about the human adaptation. I thought that was one of the more intriguing parts of your brief.
Sure.
So, and my question is just... Your point is that EPA didn't consider the possibility of human adaptation. And as I read that, I wondered, how would EPA do that? Can you give me some examples of
sure.
how it would do that? Assuming it could.
Yes.
Assuming it could. How would it do that?
I'll give you the examples, and I don't want to talk why the statute actually compels that result. The examples are, I'll give you two examples.
What? You don't want to what?
You answer the question, and then your time's going to be up. So please answer the question.
Yes, Chief Judge Sentell.
Time's up now, and we've talked you past it, but you do answer the question, please.
Thank you, Chief Judge Sentell. The examples, I'll give the main example, would be the urban heat island effect.
Urban what?
The urban heat island effect.
Yeah.
You know, it's warmer in cities, as everyone recognizes, than it is in the country.
Yeah.
Over the course of the 20th century, the warming was 4 to 5 degrees Celsius. And that's the warming that's sort of the worst case scenario of the IPCC report. And yet, people who live in cities are healthier, generally, than people who live in rural areas.
Your theory is that as climate gets warmer, people will move to northern climates where it's cooler and we won't, right? Is that the argument?
You know, organic migration is one aspect of adaptation mitigation.
Let's assume you're right about that. That's going to happen. How would EPA possibly do that? How would it account for that possibility?
I think it would look for historic analogs like the urban heat island effect. So the urban heat island effect accrued over the course of a century. The major cities of the world, Tokyo, London, New York, this is all in the record. They experienced these, you know, 4 to 5 degree, which is 7 to 9 degrees Celsius increases, and yet they did not experience, you know, negative health impacts over those times. They dealt with those, and they wound up actually seeing an advance in human welfare, not a retreat on human welfare.
And if it did that, how would EPA know that these human migrations in the future. That's what you're talking about, right? It's got to be, it's a predictive judgment, correct? That humans will in the future move to avoid the consequences. How does EPA, how does it predict that, and how does it know whether those human migration patterns are sufficient to overcome the effects of the dangers flowing from warming?
Well, I don't think that question is any less complex than the things EPA is predicting, like, you know, millimeter rises in sea levels over a 90-year period of time. Or
that question.
Your Honor, I think expert agencies could grapple with a predictive judgment that's based on economics and human experience every bit as much as they could grapple with it based on scientific issues like climate change.
Yeah,
you're another one who's not an answer. Right. You may not like their predicting on the scientific thing, but the question now is how they're going to predict the demographic question that Judge Tatel's asking about. Now, tell us an answer to that that doesn't say anything about sea level.
All right. Your Honor, I guess I would submit to you that maybe my economist friends would disagree with me, but it can be simpler to predict those kinds of shifts than it can be to predict the weather or the climate, you know, a century hence.
Let me try, and then I'll let you sit down. Just a quick sort of hypothetical about this. Suppose we were talking about a different pollutant. Say, for example, a pollutant that was a carcinogen, right? And there's no, we're not debating whether it's cancer-causing or not. Now, we know, you know, over many generations, human science has progressed. We've developed many cures for diseases. Does EPA, in your view, before it makes an endangerment finding about that particular cancer-causing pollutant, have to take account of the fact that we might someday find a cure for cancer?
Your Honor, several responses to that. I think in your hypothetical, the difference between that and greenhouse gases is that those, you know, whether you're talking about a pollutant that you inhale that causes cancer.
Don't go there. We're we're talking about whether or not, well, maybe is that the answer, that you don't have to do it for a pollutant that you inhale, but they do have to take account of human adaptation for pollutants that we don't inhale?
Your Honor, I think that there is a structural difference and a definitional difference in the statute between pollutants that cause direct human health effects and pollutants that cause welfare effects. If you're talking about a pollutant that causes a welfare effect over a...
Back to my question about cancer.
Sure.
A carcinogen. Under your theory, EPA have to account for the possibility that we'll find a cure for cancer before it could issue an endangerment finding for that carcinogen?
Your Honor, because we're dealing with something that doesn't creep up or, you know, accrete organically over a century period of time to cause its effects, we're talking about something that you breathe it in and it causes damage to your body. It's a different situation.
Suppose it only causes cancer to 0.1% of the population.
Your Honor, we wouldn't be here making this argument if we were talking about a direct public health damaging pollutant.
But I'm not sure how you can even make the distinction anymore after Mass. I know you don't want to talk about Mass v. EPA, but didn't Mass v. EPA kind of resolve this question about Mass v. EPA says it's any pollutant, any chemical that's in the atmosphere. It didn't say it had to be one that you inhale.
Again, with respect there, Your Honor, it didn't consider the difference in the definitions between a direct public health pollutant and a public welfare pollutant.
The other decided that there wasn't any distinction, didn't it?
No, Your Honor. What it rejected was EPA's...
decided that it could, that EPA not only could but had to consider this type of health effect. I'm not sure where in that Massachusetts case you're finding the distinction that you're now relying on.
The distinction is in Section 302 in terms of defining the different types of pollutants. But what the Supreme Court rejected in Mass versus EPA, Your Honor, to be clear, was the EPA's prior argument that greenhouse gases were not a pollutant at all. But this argument is not an argument that goes to whether it's saying that they're not pollutants at all, but rather that there are different types of pollutants under the statute.
We have talked to you well past your time, so unless my colleagues have further questions, we will hear from... the respondent, I believe, Mr. Lipschultz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Jack Lipschultz from the Justice Department, here on behalf of EPA. With me today is my co-counsel, Angeline Purdy, and Carol Yonku, representing the Intervenor Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Before I begin, let me just express our thanks, and I'm sure the thanks to the other counsel for the court's assistance managing this complex case, and the court staff as well, who I know have spent a lot of time making everything go smoothly. So
we daily thank our staff for the job they're doing for us.
We certainly appreciate it. It's not been an easy case, I'm sure, to manage. I will address the general legal standards and factors under Section 202A1, and Ms. Purdy will address the record and technical issues as well as the reconsideration issues. I'd like to focus my remarks on three main points. One is that an endangerment finding under the statute is properly focused on health and welfare effects. Second, that an endangerment finding is properly viewed as a judgment, not a fact-finding exercise. And three, that there's really no statutory basis for the consideration of the additional factors posited by petitioners as part of the endangerment finding. On the first issue, the focus on health and welfare, the beginning of this inquiry is the statute. The statute's broken in pertinent part here into two parts. 202A1 sets forth the endangerment factors. Section 202A2 sets forth costs and other factors that are relevant to the standard setting. So clearly, just in the structure of the statute itself, there's a recognition of the separation of those factors. Massachusetts versus EPA, of course, is controlling here in this recent decision from the Supreme Court that's directly on point, and there's been plenty of discussion here that we agree with, which is that the Supreme Court couldn't have been more clear that EPA's judgment under Section 202E1 for an endangerment finding has to be focused on the health and welfare criteria. The question really is simply whether EPA has enough information to make the scientific judgment. And if any further confirmation is needed, there's extensive legislative...
Oh, but welfare is a pretty broad concept, right? I mean, the health part of it is clearly focuses your attention, but welfare is a far broader concept, isn't it?
Yes.
And if you're just looking at the word welfare, there's nothing that, would require the agency to focus only on health benefits, in fact, or even scientific benefits, scientific issues. Welfare is a very broad concept here.
But what we're talking about are impacts to welfare from climate change, impacts to health from climate change. What the petitioners are talking about here are other factors entirely, collateral effects, for instance, the effects on stationary sources that may flow from a vehicle rule and things of that nature. So they're very different concepts. My colleague, Ms. Purdy, will explain the agency's rationale for making the positive finding with regard to health and welfare. But the critical point here is that that's what Congress wanted EPA to focus on, was health and welfare, not some of these extraneous issues that the petitioners are positing. Another line of argument from the petitioners is that EPA's judgment needed to be quantified in more of an assessment of threshold safe and unsafe levels of climate change. And while EPA certainly has discretion to weigh and balance risks, there's nothing in either this court's en banc decision in Ethel or in the legislative history from 1977 where Congress expressly adopted that decision that supports petitioner's argument on this, and in fact, it refutes it. Page 18 of the Ethel decision, for instance, the court says there's no fixed probability of harm required. At pages 55 to 56, which we discussed in our brief.
It says no fixed probability.
That's right.
But explain to me how, I understand your argument about this quantification point, but from the point of view of a reviewing court, how do we review a judgment that isn't at all quantified? I mean, in other words, can you give me an example? Under your theory, all an agency has to do is say, we reviewed the science is sound, and exercising our judgment, we make an endangerment finding. right? How, without some level of quantification, even a range of risks, what possible way does a reviewing court have to assess that agency judgment?
I think the arbitrary and capricious standard provides you
well,
that.
I know it does, but I'm asking you how we would do that.
Well,
unless we were able to see, I mean, suppose we were, obviously one answer to my question might be, well, you can look at the scientific evidence they relied on, and it's plainly unreliable. It's not peer-reviewed, right? That would be easy. But suppose it is. Suppose there's nothing wrong with the underlying science, but... And maybe your answer is that this is the nature of judicial review under the APA. I just don't see how, without some sort of quantification, a reviewing court has any basis for making an arbitrary and capricious judgment.
Well, I think we have very good guidance on this exact point from the extensive legislative history in 1977, yeah. and from this court's Ethel decision, and in both of those places.
Yeah, I know what Ethel says. I'm just asking you the general. Sitting up here today, I'm just asking you how we do this.
Legislative history can possibly have to do with answering Judge Taylor.
Well, on a practical level, I think we could say this. What we have here is a very multidimensional problem. And as we've discussed in brief, and as Ms. Purdy can discuss further, on any number of different components, there are quantitative factors. EPA has looked at quantitative information. It's looked at sea level rise. It's looked at temperature changes. It's looked at greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. There's a lot of empirical data on here in this case. The only petitioners have tried to make it look like a standardless exercise simply by saying it's not like Ethel, where we were focusing on something very tangible.
I guess what I'm asking you is the process that the APA requires, is the process here, is it just a question of process? That is, did the agency look at reliable science, make a judgment? Well, let me back this way. Is the agency's judgment about the quality of the science relied on a rational judgment? And is that the only question we ask, or is there something more?
No, I think that is largely the question that is asked under the standard. For a case like this, the court...
There's something defective in the underlying science that the agency relies on, there's no possibility of... There's no legitimate way in which a court exercising its authority under the APA could question that judgment, its ultimate judgment.
I think largely that's true. I think the court could question whether EPA explained its rationale in a way that was persuasive. I'm paraphrasing, but in the legislative history, and this is quoted in our brief, the Congress said something to the effect of, the court is not to address the court's role. It's not supposed to be sitting as a scientist or a chemist or whatnot. It's supposed to be simply seeing whether the administrator exercised his or her judgment that Congress is authorizing.
My question is, how do we know whether the administrator did that without... What? How do we know whether the administrator did that without giving us some quantifiable measure, even a range?
Well,
how do we know?
I think there's various levels that answer, but a lot of it is process. We have a process at the administrative level that the court can look at. We have an extensive administrative record here, and EPA thoroughly explained its rationale. This proceeding provides the petitioners to highlight for the court what it perceives are things that EPA missed, judgments it made that the petitioners think were wrong, and that sort of thing. The court can see for itself whether there's merit to that. Ultimately, though, what the court is looking at is not whether EPA got the right or wrong answer, but whether EPA had a reasonable basis for the answer it did choose. And that's the court's role here.
It has to also adequately explain its rationale.
Yes, it does. Certainly. One other point, and this is a small point, but I think it's a telling one. I think we need to remember that when in 1977, Congress didn't just talk a lot about statute, it changed the statute. And it changed the statute in a way that's important. It changed it from a former standard of will endanger to the present standard of may reasonably be anticipated danger, which in and of itself clearly reflects a grant of discretion and judgment to the administrator. And I noticed in preparing for this argument that in the Texas State reply brief at 6, I'm sure this was inadvertent, but I think it's telling, after summarizing what they think EPA should have done, they characterize it as what EPA should have done was set a threshold at which climate change will endanger the public health and welfare. And I think in some ways that is an illustration of the dynamic on that argument in this case. The petitioners are hoping that EPA could engage in a quantitative exercise, which simply isn't what Congress directed EPA to do in carrying out an endangerment finding. I also wanted to turn to the additional factors issues. Petitioners have talked a lot about looking broadly at the statute for guidance, and I think that it's important to remember that there's plenty of precedent in this court and we discussed some of it in our briefs. It says when an agency, when the specific statutory question involves an assessment of factors set out in a statute, and the statute sets them out as Section 202A1 does, those are the factors that EPA is supposed to focus on, not other factors. And that's a general principle embodied in this court's precedent, but it's specifically consistent with Massachusetts versus EPA, which is focusing on the very question that we're answering today. So that I think is the background. On the question of efficacy, how much should the emission standards really address the endangerment? There are a few points I just would like to make quickly. One is, of course, the statute is broken into two parts, as we've been saying. To the extent Congress wanted to set forth factors for the emission standards, it did so in Section 202A2. The other thing I think is important to remember is this idea that the vehicle rule in and of itself has to be shown by EPA to ameliorate the endangerment. Not only has no support in the statute, but it's impractical. The endangerment finding here is a categorical finding for all two Section 202A1 sources. Petitioners don't contest that 202A sources, 202A sources contribute to climate change. And the vehicle rule is just the first regulation. As the Supreme Court recognized in the standing part of its discussion in Massachusetts versus EPA, agencies don't attack a problem all at once. Generally, they start with one regulation, they build on it, and they build on it, and they build on it.
Well, I want to ask someone, and I think this is for your colleague rather than you, but I don't want to let it get dropped, about the two gases that are not emitted by the internal combustion engines that nonetheless wind up in the mix of 6 that are the foundation for the studies.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Purdy will be addressing that issue for you.
I wanted to make sure I didn't drop it between the two.
No, I appreciate it, and I know that's one of the challenges of this Division of Labor. So I'd also like to address the stationary source argument and the absurdity argument. As we've discussed in our brief, on the statutory question, I mean, not only do we have very, very strong guidance from the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, but we should also remember the Supreme Court's decision in Whitman, which, although was a slightly different statute, was looking at the NAAQS provision, which is also focused on health and welfare, and really ruled out consideration of costs in that context, which is essentially the argument that petitioners are making here. The PSD implications that they're concerned about, which will be discussed tomorrow, I don't want to get into it too much, but they arise by operation of statute, not by any decision EPA really had the discretion to make here. And on the absurd results issue, I think that we would agree with Judge Tatel's discussion of this issue in his dissenting opinion in this court's Massachusetts versus EPA decision when this issue came up with regard to arguments about the NAAQS, not PSD, but the same principle applies. And what Judge Tatel said then is what EPA said here, which is that if there is going to be an absurdity arising out of stationary source provisions, the way to address it is narrowly in those provisions, not by ruling out Section 202 regulations.
My colleagues have questions.
No.
Seeing none, I will hear from Ms. Priddy.
Just one housekeeping matter, Your Honor. One housekeeping matter, I just wanted to say that we were not planning either to address the Science Advisory Board review issue, but if the court had questions about that, I'd be the one
if
to ask them.
If you had questions, you would be the one to ask right, so questions about the SAB. Just,
yeah, what's your theory? I was curious. You say this wasn't circulated formally, right?
That's right.
Well, where do you get any authority for well, in that the, as a requirement?
In the
you didn't cite anything for it.
Yeah, the portion of the joint appendix where EPA discussed that issue cited as a contrast a portion of the ESA, EISA statute, the fuel economy statute, where in the statute itself there were consultation requirements with other agencies provided for.
But there's nothing about this statute that says that, is there?
That was EPA's point, I think. EPA was saying that the Science Advisory Board provisions say that where formal consultation is required, it's one of the triggering conditions. And EPA was saying here the statute doesn't require formal consultation like other statutes do. They gave an example in the provision in the record provision cited in our brief. There's a cross-reference to a 49 USC provision. That's a provision of a fuel economy statute.
And OMB review is not
right, because it's created by executive order, and that was the distinction EPA was getting at.
Okay. Thank you, Counselor. We'll
thank you.
Ms. Purdy.
Good morning, Your Honor. Angeline Purdy, and as Mr. Lipschultz indicated, I will be discussing the scientific and technical basis for the endangerment finding, also EPA's denial of reconsideration, and any questions concerning the definition of air pollutant to include six gases. I'd like to begin with EPA's actual endangerment finding, since there were some questions concerning the actual conclusion reached. Petitioners are correct that EPA concluded that that most of the observed increase in global average temperatures since the mid-20th century is very likely due to the observed increase in human-generated greenhouse gas emissions, and very likely is a defined term, which means 90 to 99% certain. So that is correctly stated. But what, as Judge Tatel has recognized, however, where we differ is in the contention that the lines of evidence supporting this are themselves weak and uncertain. I think the question for the court is, again, as Judge Tatel identified, whether EPA looked at reliable science and made a rational judgment based on that science. And that's
liability would be before us only at the very margin.
yes, Your Honor, because that is a question
you
that is to
be.
You
don't have to decide you're right. be very careful what you ask for, you might get it.
correct. as I was about to add to that, that is, of course, a question to be answered in light of the deference that's due EPA's technical judgment and the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. So, no, the court is not asked to decide for itself, yes, the science was good or no, it was bad, only whether EPA made a rational decision that the science was reliable. By any measure, EPA's decision that this is reliable science should be upheld. EPA looked at thorough assessments that canvassed literally thousands of peer-reviewed studies, took those peer-reviewed studies, assembled them into bodies of assessment that then are themselves peer-reviewed. There are layers of public review as well for the major assessments. This then all went through public review and comment, as well as EPA's technical support document going through peer review within EPA. And with all of this, all that petitioners have been able to identify are some marginal uncertainties that, as the court has recognized, EPA has accounted for, EPA recognized these uncertainties, and EPA concluded that they were not so profound as to prevent EPA from making the endangerment finding called for by Massachusetts v. EPA. Regarding the three lines of evidence that EPA relied on, those being evidence of warming temperatures, it's EPA's general knowledge of the climate system, computer models. Each one of those in turn has its own foundation. Warming temperatures isn't just temperatures are going up. It's three data sets all showing this. So there's an enormous foundation that all leads up ultimately to this conclusion. There was some discussion over, you know, this is all thoroughly discussed in the brief. It's in terms of the specific uncertainties that petitioners have identified. We're happy to answer any questions the court may have on that.
What I have a question about, and it frankly disturbs me, is the conclusion. Everything APA does here is based on a mix of six gases, only four of which are actually emitted by the regulated motor vehicles. I confess that after reading the EPA and the briefs, I still was not at all certain why the other two gases were included in coming to those conclusions.
Because of the different findings that EPA is actually making under Section 202, what Section 202 asks is whether air pollution may reasonably be anticipated to endanger human health or welfare. And EPA said, okay, whether emissions of an air pollutant cause or, and whether emissions of an air pollutant cause, yes.
Of those two gases here. The source you're regulating or would be regulating on the basis of the endangerment does not emit two of the gases that seem to be conceded. And yet all the calculation is based on a mix that includes those two.
The air pollutant that EPA concluded causes or contributes to the air pollution, which ultimately endangers human health or welfare, is defined in terms of the six major greenhouse gases, yes. And EPA's basis for that is discussed in the record, that these all share common properties, they're all directly emitted, they're all known to contribute to warming.
Two of them are not emitted by the sources that you're regulating.
Two of them are not emitted by automobiles, but the air pollutant.
That's what
yes.
You're regulating in the first instance.
And
everything else is dependent upon that, isn't it?
The
stationary sources don't come into play until after you have made the first decisions based on the motor vehicles, right?
Stationary sources do not come into play until actual emissions are regulated as a result of motor vehicle regulation. And I counsel addressing the vehicle rule and the stationary and the timing and tailoring rule may be in a better position to address specifically what is and isn't regulated under those rules. But in turn, the question here is, did EPA appropriately define the air pollutant to consist of the six major greenhouse gases that all share common properties and that are, that equate to the six greenhouse gases that constitute the air?
That if none of them were emitted by automobiles, you couldn't regulate them under this process, right?
Well, if automobiles did not emit any of those agents that EPA has found to constitute the air pollutant, then there would be no emissions to be regulated.
Right. So why are you including two non-emitted gases in coming up to the conclusion of whether the emission is in fact creating an endangerment, triggering the regulation of motor vehicles, and in turn triggering the regulation of stationary sources?
Because at the stage of there's a multi-step analysis. What is the air pollution? Does that air pollution is that air pollution reasonably anticipated to endanger? What is the air pollutant? And in this case, EPA did, as it has done with many other substances, as it has done with VOCs, as it has done with particulate matter. So the air pollutant.
Particulate matter is not a parallel. Particulate matter is a result of the size of the particle, right? You use that parallel in the analysis, but that struck me as not being parallel at all.
If particulate matter is not a parallel, consider VOCs, because those are substances. There are hundreds of VOCs. EPA has not determined that each and every individual VOC is an air pollutant. It has said there is an air pollutant consisting of VOCs. And if you emit any one of the things, or any two or three or five or however many of the things that are within this definition of air pollutant, you are regulated. That's what's happening here. EPA has said there is an air pollutant that consists of these six greenhouse gases. If you emit one of those or two of those or four of those.
On the basis of the four that are in fact emitted by the regulated source.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
EPA have analyzed this on the basis of the four that are four components of the pollutant or four pollutants that are in fact emitted by the regulated motor vehicles?
It could have, Your Honor, and if it had done so, it would have reached the same conclusion. It states in the record.
That's the next step of what's stated, and what I want to know now is how do we know that?
I'm sorry, how do we?
That maybe it would be the same result. I don't know precisely why it would be the same result.
Your Honor, we know it because EPA has said that it would reach the same conclusion. It would have concluded.
Well, it predicts it. How do we know it would reach the same reasoned conclusion just because it says it would reach the same conclusion?
I think, Your Honor, because all of the evidence in the record concerning the effects of greenhouse gases, the effects that, that greenhouse gases have on the climate, on climate change, all of that is not broken out into carbon dioxide does this, methane does that. They're analyzed as a group. They're treated as a group.
That's precisely the basis of my question. You've come full circle now. You're back to where I asked you to begin with. Why are they treated as a group? Why couldn't we have had analysis of the particular gases emitted by the regulated industry or regulated entities?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, there is at least information in the record, although that's not sort of the basis on which EPA reached the decision, but there is information in the record concerning gases emitted by, you know, specific gases that are emitted by the Section 202 sources, which is the only thing that was of concern in this case. Regarding why these greenhouse gases are treated as a group, that's how the science looks at them. It does not break out carbon dioxide from methane, from PFCs. These are all directly emitted. They're all long-lived. They mix in the atmosphere in a way that makes it difficult to pull out one and say, well, carbon dioxide is doing this, whereas methane is doing that. These all have common effects, and they all mix in the atmosphere, so they've been treated and analyzed. And that was the basis for EPA looking at the grouping these six, was that these are the six that have been the focus of the science on which EPA relied.
Have there been other there are other pollutants that EPA has combined in this way, aren't there, other than greenhouse gases like PM?
Yes, Your Honor, PM. Another example would be VOCs, as we were just discussing.
Uh-huh. VOCs may be the closest parallel. Uh-huh.
If that addresses your question, Judge Santel, if I could just go back from...
This is it. Now, whether it answers your question, I'll free you to go on to other things.
I think you also make the point that no petitioner contends it would not be subject to regulation, but for the inclusion of those two other gases.
That's correct, Your Honor. They haven't identified any sources.
Ask them about when they get up for rebuttal.
Turning back, I think, to the science that supported EPA's decision, there was some discussion of the specific issue of solar radiation. This actually, I think, is a good example of the kind of things that the petitioners are doing with regard to EPA's knowledge and their actual EPA's own descriptions of that knowledge. They've characterized this as EPA saying, well, we don't understand solar radiation, but we do understand solar radiation. And that's simply not a reflection of EPA's actual analysis. EPA has said there are certain aspects of this we understand extremely well. There are others we don't understand as well. When you take all of that into account, we're able to reach reasonable conclusions about what solar radiation does, what clouds do, what the forces within the climate do, all of those.
So that's back to sort of how does a court review that?
Precisely, Your Honor. And I think the question for the court is whether, given everything in the record, given EPA, the deference to EPA's technical judgment, the ultimate conclusion can be said to be arbitrary and capricious, and petitioners have not shown that. As I noted, there are a great number of scientific issues discussed in the briefs and the record, and I'm happy to address any further of those that the court has questions over, but I don't know that running through each of them would be necessary. I'd like then to discuss the EPA's action on the reconsideration petitions.
Could I just ask one, though, question?
Of course.
The petitioners argue that it was not enough for EPA to look at these three major studies, these composites, as it were, that it really had to examine, as it were, the science underneath the studies that were examined. And EPA's brief says something to the extent, well, in some of these studies, EPA officials were actually involved. But in addition, you have the various layers of peer review. And I guess the bottom line is EPA says, well, there's no court decision, much less a statutory requirement, that EPA conduct all of this science originally on itself. So that gets the court's review, as it were, even a step further removed from the science itself, if you understand what I'm saying.
I don't think, though, Your Honor, that the court's review is any further removed than it is in any other case in which an agency has relied on outside science, which agencies do routinely, and which this court has said is perfectly appropriate. I think the record amply demonstrates that EPA did not just blindly rely on these assessments. It looked very carefully at how good the science was, at the layers of peer review, at the depth of the field that was covered, at the number of studies that were looked at. There have also been numerous layers of public review of all of this. So there's absolutely nothing extraordinary about EPA having not reinvented the wheel and gone back and redone science that it concluded had already been thoroughly canvassed. Regarding EPA's denial of the petitions for reconsideration, their argument proceeds from a false premise, which is that EPA somehow revised the endangerment finding. We didn't. The endangerment finding stands on its own merits and on its own record. If there had never been reconsideration petitions, if EPA had never said a word about those petitions, it would still stand based on that record. In fact, what EPA did was exactly what they say we should do.
I think part of their argument was that it would be one thing if the agency had said, based on the record that was already before it, we've examined what petitioners say and we've examined what petitioners have submitted by way of additional evidence and find, it is not of central significance here. But what, in fact, EPA did was to say, well, we've looked at what the petitioners have submitted, and in our response, here we have other things to support our original conclusion.
I think that's a misstatement on two levels, Your Honor, of what EPA actually did. The first is just the idea that EPA added a huge volume of material to the record. Materials that were added to the docket in connection with the reconsideration process. There's sort of two groups of those. One is a group of materials that were added that were consistent with material that's normally added, you know, very late in the rulemaking process, final drafts of the TSD, for instance, response to comments, materials such as that. That's something like 200 documents in itself. The bulk of the rest of the material that was added to the docket in connection with the reconsideration proceeding was simply the reconsideration petitions themselves and the vast body of material that EPA that was submitted with those reconsideration petitions, or that, in many cases, the reconsideration petitioners referred to but did not submit, so EPA then went in and added that information to the docket. So the idea that there was this huge wealth of information added to the docket that EPA relied on, I think, is mistaken. I think the second level is the argument they've made that we had to prove that EPA would change its mind. And in fact, all that EPA did here was apply the statutory standard in the way that it has long interpreted it to say, is there substantial support that we should revisit an endangerment finding that is already thoroughly supported, that has been 10 years in the making by that point? Have you given us a good reason to think that we should revisit that finding? Not have you convinced us you would win, but is there even a good reason to think that we should reopen this? And EPA properly concluded that there was not.
Suppose the agency relied on these three major studies. Suppose in denying the petition for rehearing, it pointed to a fourth study.
EPA did, there's reference in the denial of the petition for rehearing to a fourth recent study from the NRC, I believe, if that's what Your Honor is referring to specifically.
Yeah. Right.
But that was not a primary basis for EPA's denial. EPA cited that study as basically being in accord with the conclusion it had reached, which was, if you look at the material submitted with the
Why shouldn't the public have an opportunity to comment on that judgment? I mean, suppose that judgment's wrong.
The public does not have an opportunity to comment on that judgment because
No, I was asking you why they shouldn't. I mean, because it's a fourth reason. It seems to me it isn't an answer to the question to say, well, you know, all it did was support our conclusion. Maybe it doesn't, and why shouldn't the public have a? In other words, what I'm getting at is the agency has brought in an additional support for the conclusion already made, and if that reinforces the agency's decision that its original decision is correct, then why isn't that something that should be made available for public comment?
Your Honor, because that's not how the reconsideration process is set up under the statute. The reconsideration process is set up with a statutory standard that gives EPA, that places the judgment of whether petitioners have made a demonstration that they presented information of central relevance. They have to make that demonstration to the administrator. It does not call for public comment in making that determination. I think the second level.
If you granted
yes.
reconsideration, then there would be public comment.
If we granted reconsideration.
What Judge Tatel's trying to get to is if you rely on something that was not relied upon in the first decision, why shouldn't that be the occasion for reconsideration so the public can comment? It's not an answer to just say, well, we don't do things that way.
First, I want to stress that the NRC study, if you wanted to just take that out, EPA's conclusion that it should deny the petitions for reconsideration would still stand and would still be supported by the record. So the fact that EPA did not allow the public to comment on this would not have made a difference.
In
to
other
EPA's
words, your point is under the statutory standard, it's not a question of central relevance. Is that your point?
That the materials presented with the petition for reconsideration did not rise to the level that present information that was of central relevance to the outcome of the rule. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to figure out where we draw the line. I mean, obviously, there's got to be. I mean, you concede, I assume, that there could be situations where. I mean, take for example an easier case. Let's assume that the agency relies on one study for its original decision. And in support of denying the petition for rehearing, it cites four more studies that reach the same conclusion. Now,
Your Honor, I can't speak to what might happen in such a case, but in this case, even without the NRC study, which EPA cited as merely being in accord with the conclusions it had independently reached regarding the merits of the petitions for reconsideration, it was not relying on this as a reason for denying them. It was saying,
I'm just trying to find out whether you think there's some limit at all to what an agency can do, can add to the record in support of a denial. Suppose in my hypothetical it's suppose there's one study that supports the agency's original decision, and then in the denial of rehearing, the second study is just a completely different theory, but nevertheless supports it. In other words, it looks at the issue a totally different way, it reaches the same conclusion. And now, is your point there that the agency could say, we're looking at that because it convinces us that petitioners have not raised an issue of central relevance, that is because given this new study, it isn't substantially likely that it would lead to a different result?
Your Honor, I'm loath to speculate as to what
hypothetical.
I'm not sure I've completely followed your hypothetical, but in theory, yes. Is there some point at which an agency would be adding so much new material or creating such new issues and looking at a reconsideration petition that it should allow notice and comment before even ruling on that petition? I can speculate that that point might exist, but we haven't reached that point in this case. Because EPA, even based just on the material submitted with the reconsideration petitions and its thoughtful consideration of them at that material in light of the entire pre-existing record, concluded that those petitions should be denied. I think, again, there is a great deal of material with those petitions that's been discussed in detail in the briefs. I would like to just very briefly address the specific issue of the CRU emails, because that was the big gun in the reconsideration petitions. EPA looked at each and every one of those emails. It looked at them in context. It looked at them in light of the entire record. And that's why, it's one of the reasons, EPA's denial is as long as it is. That's why that 360-page response to petitions, because the petitions themselves were so lengthy. But ultimately, what they weren't was substantial. And petitioners have not identified any deficiency in EPA's response. They have not come back and said, well, you said this email was really talking about this, but you're wrong, because they have merely reiterated the arguments made in their petitions for reconsideration, arguments that EPA properly rejected. I also would be prepared to address any questions concerning EPA's actual findings regarding endangerment and the health and welfare issues. Judge Tatel, I believe you had some questions on that, or was I misunderstanding the questions that you were asking Mr. Lifshultz?
No, none for you.
If the court has no...
Unless you want to explain models to us.
I would be happy to, Your Honor, but I'm not sure I can explain the full depth of models, but of course I would be happy to discuss EPA's reliance on climate models if the court has questions.
Could you say a couple words about their complaint about the modeling here?
Certainly, Your Honor. Their complaint about the modeling, as I understand it, their central complaint is that the models either aren't valid models or that the projections they produce are not in line with actual, with observed conditions. And that if the model projections don't match observed projections, then, or excuse me, don't match observed temperatures, then the models must be bad and the modeling must be bad. I think it's useful to step back and look at the fact that, again, you know, when these climate models are used, you're talking about a study done by a modeler that's been peer-reviewed and that's then been peer-reviewed again as part of the IPCC process or the USGCRP process.
What specifically about their argument that the use of the models here is circular? That is, that they've been added to mm-hmm. by data that itself comes from the models.
I think what Your Honor is referring to is specifically the reanalysis argument that they made. What reanalysis is it's one method by which some models are validated. It's not the way that all climate models are validated, and that is a process by which, again, a model is validated by looking at whether its projections match real-world data. So you have some real-world data. There may be some things that are incomplete in that data set, inevitably, because maybe it covers 100 locations but doesn't have a data point at the 101st. So you take that data set, you run it through a model that has already been valid and that can use principles of physics, what it knows about the climate system, to fill in any interstices in that data set. You then take the model you're trying to validate and you compare its projections against that augmented data set. So it's not circular. You're not running data and then crunching it back through the model and saying, oh, look, the model predicted the data we put into it. It's creating an augmented and more robust data set against which some models can then be validated. The very document that the petitioners cite to say, well, there's some questions about reanalysis, ultimately concludes that this is a useful tool. And this is by no means the only means by which models in general are validated. So we don't agree that it's a circular process, and to the extent that reanalysis was used on some climate models, it was an appropriate means of validation. If there are no further questions.
Being none, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We're now reached the intervener, Ms. Yonku.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carol Yonku, representing the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and on behalf of a coalition of states and environmental groups. It's been a long morning, so I will be brief.
Good.
The adverse impacts of greenhouse gas pollution that the administrator is charged with preventing are occurring and are continuing to occur, and no one seriously disputes that as greenhouse gas pollution as greenhouse gas concentrations.
In which case are you rising?
Excuse me?
To which issue in the case are you rising?
I am going to the legal. I'm getting to a concrete point here, Your Honor. I am trying to make the point that as no one disputes that as greenhouse gas levels accumulate in the atmosphere, the magnitude of the harms will increase. And so this case for Massachusetts and the other states is about just that. It's about people's lives.
I thought that's what petitioners were arguing. I thought they were saying the science didn't support that.
Yeah.
Isn't that their whole case?
Excuse me?
Everyone
Isn't that their whole case?
That seems right. Disputed by lots of people. Right.
No, is it petitioner's primary case here that the science doesn't support the conclusion you just stated?
I believe that's not
no?
what I heard from the other side, Your Honor, that Mr. One of the arguers, in fact.
What issue that we have to decide are you addressing?
I am making the point that what EPA did, what the administrator decided, was wholly consistent with the congressional design of the statute, with the statutory language, consistent with Supreme Court precedent, and fully compliant with and based on sound science. And it should be upheld. For Massachusetts and the other states, this is about people's lives and livelihoods. It's about our land and our natural resources. Massachusetts, for example, 75% of our population lives in coastal communities that are subject to the harms associated with sea level rise. It is occurring, it's continuing to occur, and the most recent study in the record shows that, in fact, in the Northeast, it is predicted to exceed global averages, the amount of sea level rise. That's why we've been pursuing federal regulation for so many years. The goal of the Clean Air Act is to reduce pollution and protect public health, and the endangerment finding is the first step in doing that. It was completely compliant with congressional design, Supreme Court precedent, and based on sound science. And this record, if this isn't endangerment, then it is hard to imagine what it would take to make endangerment. This should be upheld. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. Petitioner's time, of course, was used up, but we will give 5 minutes back for rebuttal to whomever the petitioners wish to stand up. We will take one.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a couple points to cover. We're going to try to focus on the legal issues, not to the detriment of the record-based issues, which are important to the case, but to try to focus on those. The first one I'd like to turn to is the two gas versus the six gas issue. We do think that is a serious legal error, Your Honor. We're talking about Section 202, the mobile source provision of the statute that deals with emissions from automobiles, and we have EPA essentially building the groundwork to regulate two pollutants that don't come out of automobiles.
Isn't that true of any situation where EPA has combined a number of pollutants into one, like PM or VOX?
No, we think that the PM analogy is inapposite because all of those pollutants are indistinguishable, and there are so many sources that it would be impossible really to distinguish them.
You're questioning whether or not EPA's judgment about combining these particular six was an arbitrary and capricious judgment, right? That's your argument there, that these six aren't sufficiently similar to be combined, whereas in PM they were. But my only point about raising PM or the other one, VOX, was that, you know, there are many, many sources are regulated subject to those standards, even though they don't emit every one of the pollutants that makes up the mix.
Your Honor, we think that it's both an issue of statutory construction of 202A and an arbitrary and capricious issue. We think the explanation for this is that EPA, despite what they say at some times when it's convenient that they're myopically focusing on 202A1 like a laser beam, in reality, they were building a regulatory structure here for the entire statute.
Doesn't 202A1 say, or a combination of them?
There is a reference to the definition of pollutant to combination. So, yes, EPA does have some discretion to combine, but we would submit that...
Then what's the statutory argument?
The statutory argument is if you're dealing with pollutants that do not even come from automobiles, that you're not properly making a determination about endangerment based on those gases in 202A.
Okay.
Turning to the second point on adaptation... And this is why we think that's a Chevron step one argument. It's the term in the statute is that reasonably anticipated to endanger. And if you ignore the issue of adaptation, we think that you're not engaging in a reasonable anticipation. And we think EPA has read that word out of the statute. The third point was I heard Mr. Lipschultz say and invoke your dissent, Your Honor, in the Massachusetts versus EPA case. In that dissent, you relied on the MOVA decision. And in the MOVA decision, if you look at it, you'll see that it specifically says...
This was a dissent, right?
This
Why
was
do
a
we
dissent.
Care at this point?
Your Honor, we take even your dissents very seriously.
We had one vote, so why don't... I mean, I wouldn't spend any time on that.
Well, then let me talk about the MOVA case itself, which was a holding of this court. In the MOVA case, which EPA invoked repeatedly in its decision here for the absurdity canon points, you can't use the absurdity canon to rewrite statutes. That's what MOVA says, but that's precisely what they did with Section 169.1. They rewrote the numerical terms to sets of numerical terms, orders of magnitude beyond that, that they were more to their liking.
I want to back up on your two guesses for a minute. Counsel for EPA suggest that you've not shown any way in which the inclusion of the two gases changed the result or caused you any harm. What would you say to that?
Our response to that is that the main one is SF6, sulfur hexafluoride. That's emitted from utility transformers, and utility interests are in this case in a prominent and important way. So we do have injury from that, Your Honor, the fact that they're building essentially groundwork for future regulation.
That seems to... I'm sorry. Jump to a different point. My questions had to do with whether they could regulate these on motor vehicles. You understand that? That was my question to begin with when I was talking to EPA.
I'm sorry.
We're under a motor vehicle regulation. That's what triggers everything else. We've got endangerment. Then you got tailpipe. Then that triggers stationary source.
Yes.
Now, how is the motor vehicle petitioner hurt by the inclusion of the other pollutants?
The motor vehicle, a strict motor vehicle purchaser of fleets would not be, but there are other petitioners in the endangerment case and the auto rule case that are not just purchasers of fleets, but rather would be regulated for their SF6.
All right, let's focus on the automobile. How is anybody dealing with automobiles hurt by the inclusion of the two gases that are not emitted by automobiles?
Anyone who...
I'm not sure I understand why EPA is so insistent on including them. It would have been simpler if they hadn't. But since they have, if there's a foul, where's the harm?
Your Honor, if a petitioner was attempting to premise their standing on purely having purchased motor vehicles, then I think it would be no harm, no foul. But there are other petitioners in this case who see the endangerment finding and then the auto rule and its triggering effects as foundational to stationary source regulation. They need to be able to challenge that, and they do have standing to challenge it because they will be regulated for their SF6 emissions.
Okay, thank you.
On the reconsideration point, just very quickly.
No, I'm not ready to leave then.
Okay.
Forget analyzing it as standing for a moment. How is there any harm in, if it's an error to include those, why isn't it a harmless error with respect to the adoption of the motor vehicle regulation?
Because, Your Honor, if the endangerment finding essentially were reviewed and you held that that were harmless error, then think about what happens down the chain. Now you're, an entity that emits SF6, and you want to challenge that as unlawful, and you're told you can't challenge that as unlawful because it happened in an earlier rulemaking. So that's one of the reasons why we filed the coordination motion to put all of these issues before the court.
But which source issues SF6? Which one is it?
Utility transformers.
Okay, is that the only one of the six greenhouse gases they emit?
No, there are others.
Well, then isn't... Then I go back to Chief Judge Santel's question. I mean, it seems to me to find someone injured by this, you've got to find someone who not only emits SF6, but it's the only one they emit, because if they emit others, then there's no harm.
There's no harm, Your Honor. There is harm because of the fact that you're still going to have to account for SF6 regulation.
No, you only have to account for carbon, for greenhouse gases under the standard, right?
But in terms of the magnitude of that, when permitting thresholds are triggered, you're affected by how much SF6 emissions there are. So if the agency unlawfully launched SF6 regulation in a prior rulemaking, you're injured by that.
Then don't we come back to the question of the one I asked earlier, which is whether the combination of them was itself arbitrary and capricious. In other words, if there were, say, five greenhouse gases and then it stuck in a sixth pollutant that had nothing to do with it, then you'd be arguing this is arbitrary and capricious, then I'd understand your argument. But I haven't heard you say what it is that prohibits them from combining the gases in the first place. I mean, the pollutants in the first place.
It's the fact, Your Honor, that it's doing it in the course of a mobile source rulemaking. And so arbitrary and capriciousness is measured against...
And it's basically, since it's not emitted by a car, even though it's identical to the, in all respects, to the other four gases, it can't be included. That's your argument.
We think it's material.
What you concede.
Right.
Identical in other respects is, if it is, then why did it need to be included? I'm not sure I follow the EPA's argument is saying it's identical in all respects.
Yes. Our point, Your Honor, Your Honors collectively, is that this
has the same characteristics, similar characteristics. Chief Judge Sintel is absolutely right. I misstated what the EPA said. but you see my point. I mean, what I'm getting at is, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Your argument is that the combination language in 202A1, that language is limited to combination of pollutants that the 2A21 source itself emits.
Yes, it refers to emissions from new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines, and that's critical because those two pollutants don't come out of new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines. So the arbitrary and capricious analysis obviously has to be informed by the statutory context. If they were making a stationary source,
and I understand. So and this is just a question. I don't know the answer. When EPA made the endangerment finding for PM and included in PM a whole series of pollutants, if I went back and looked at that finding, would I discover that the sources involved in that emitted all of those PM constituent pollutants?
You would not, Your Honor, but let me explain. You know, there are literally thousands and tens of thousands of compounds that, solids, right, liquids, gases that make up PM10. So it wouldn't be possible to do that. If you're going to have a PM10 or 2.5, you have to be able to aggregate it.
Its analysis is based on the size, not based on the composition of
the pollutant. Right. So whereas here, the analysis is based on six particular chemicals, and they're different because they have different impacts as multipliers than other ones.
What I'm still not quite certain of is your explanation as to why the result here would have been any different had it not been included. I do understand the impact on some of your, that there is standing on the part of some petitioners, perhaps, but I'm not quite sure that the rule would have been any different if it hadn't been any included.
The relief you would get for this argument, Your Honor, is that it was arbitrary and capricious and unlawful under the statute to include those two gases. So they could define a set of four motor vehicle greenhouse gases, but when they went beyond that...
If we find this to be error, then the most we could do was say that the EPA erred in the inclusion of those gases and then uphold what the EPA has done, except for the inclusion of those gases, right?
Your Honor, I think it's...
logical result, if that's the only harm involved, is that it causes some people to be regulated, some emitters, to be regulated on those gases that would not be regulated without them, would not the only relief we could grant be to vacate that part of the rule?
Your Honor, I think that could be what you do, but I also think that it's possible that EPA may take the position that it has to move as a package for some reason, and that when they exercise their discretion, they had some...
You can't speak for them on that.
Right. Right. That's why I would recommend that you vacate the entire six
that's
gas combination.
Reason you'd recommend that.
Is your representation that one of the petitioners is a utility transformer that would not otherwise be subject to regulation but for the inclusion of one of these two gases?
Your Honor, I should be precise. I cannot tell you.
The question is asking for.
Yes, I do not know if there's a utility transformer who's a direct party, but I do know that the trade association that represents such members is a petitioner, and so they would have associational standing.
They know that this utility transformer emits only those two gases? That's what I'm trying to establish.
Right. You know,
this was raised in the briefs, and I didn't see any response in the reply.
Your Honor, I shouldn't foreclose it, but I don't know of any evidence that there are particular utility interests that emit only those two gases and not other ones.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We've again taken you beyond your time. And we've taken everybody beyond their endurance for the moment, I think. So we will be taking a 10 minutes adequate.
Yeah.
Seeing no colleague objecting, a 10-minute recess. We're not guaranteeing you your seats back in the audience. I assume there's going to be changes at the council table because I see different people arguing. So this gives you your chance to yield place at the council table. Give us a 10-minute recess, please.
Stand, please. This honorable court will now take a 10-minute recess.